Welcome to Let It Roll, the podcast about how and why popular music happens, hosted by Nate Wilcox. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to all the other great Pantheon podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, Nate welcomes author James Kaplan to discuss his book, Irving Berlin, New York Genius. James tells Nate about the legendary songwriter's 50-year career from Alexander's Ragtime Band to Annie Get Your Gun. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and today I'm joined by James Kaplan, author of Irving Berlin, New York Genius. James, welcome.
Delighted to be here, Nate. Thanks for having me.
Sure. And this is a really nice book on a big topic. I mean, Irving Berlin, as Jerome Kern said, doesn't have a place in American music. He is American music. And at least up to the 1950s, that is absolutely the case. I mean, this guy had a career from 1909, still active all the way up to 1966, had a hit play in the early 50s, an incredible run. I mean, nobody in the modern era except maybe Paul McCartney could even be comparable.
Yes, and I draw a lot of comparisons, actually, between Lennon, McCartney, and Irving Berlin. Very similar work ethics, very similar brilliance at constructing songs, and a lot of similarities in the way they constructed songs.
And yet, unlike Lennon McCartney, who had, you know, their 10 incredible years, and you know, Lennon had another 5 years or so, and McCartney's maybe had another 10. I mean, Berlin kept it up and was at the top of his game through the teens, through the 20s, answered the challenge of Gershwin and Kern and the modern Broadway musical that integrates a story with the songs, all the way up, you know, into and beyond World War II. It's just an incredible achievement. And he's just a really likable guy, and reading this book really brings that across. I mean, this is a guy with what you call an innate moral compass, and avoids the temptation of most of the temptations of fame and money to an unbelievable degree. How do you explain that?
That's true. I would like to be very careful about emphasizing his high degree of morality and ethics, and pointing out at the same time that he was in a business that remains extremely competitive, full of sharp elbows, and nobody was more competitive and sharp-elbowed than Berlin. He had a keen eye for the best business opportunities. He was sharply competitive, and he could be very tough.
Absolutely. And as his, you know, founds his own music company very early on in his career. I think he'd had maybe two or three hits by the time he founds his own company. And then as a founding member of ASCAP, the publishing union that, you know, brought all the songwriters together and collected the royalties. And BMI comes along in the 40s to compete with it. But essentially, you know, Irving Berlin co-founded modern music publishing.
Yes, he was really present at the creation of the American Songbook.
And in your book, you talk about your own personal sort of discovery of Berlin. And, you know, it ties in with the New York theme that you were working as an intern for The New Yorker. I might have gotten the title wrong, but you're in a junior capacity at The New Yorker.
Well, I used to handle a now outmoded machine called a typewriter. I was an editorial typist at The New Yorker.
And, you know, kids today don't know what they're missing with those IBM
Selectric
3s.
Yeah, these kids today, I tell you, yeah.
But this was one song, the first song that you bring up in the book was one I hadn't been familiar with, which was a very early Irving Berlin song. And I hadn't realized he had recorded performances, but you found a record going back to 1909 of Irving Berlin singing a song called Oh, How That German Could Love. What fascinated you about that recording?
Well, the first thing that fascinated me about that recording was how unbelievably old it was. I didn't even know they made records in 1909. And then to hear this record that, despite the hisses and pops inevitably that came through in the reproduction process, and let us not forget that that when phonograph records were first made in the very early 1900s, there was no such thing as electronic microphone. These were made, singers sang or orchestras played through the bell of a gigantic speaking horn, a cone-like assembly that translated the vibrations of the voice or the music to a needle that etched the vibrations into a wax disc that was then converted into a shellac disc that could be played on this new fangled instrument called a phonograph. So all of this process was necessary, and yet piercing through this process was the unbelievably light, witty, engaging voice of a kind of genius who was coming up with this very funny popular song, this very funny take on the silly ethnic songs of the early 1900s. The title itself gives you a hint. Oh, how that German could love. It was about a very curvy German lady who this singer was infatuated with. And it's such a beguiling performance.
And in the book, you call it Modernism on the Hoof. Startling formal innovation smuggled into a seemingly banal idiom. Elaborate on that a little bit. What does that mean, modernism?
Here is this 21-year-old. He's 21 years old. And I ask you or any of the listeners to think of themselves at 21. I think of myself at 21 when I could just about tie my shoes. This is a guy who's 21 years old who is not only fully engaging with the art of songwriting, but he is making fun of it. He is both succeeding in it and satirizing it at the same time. And so, again, back in the very early 20th century, you had these waves upon waves of immigrants arriving in America at Ellis Island. And as a result of that, kind of in reaction to it and also paying homage to it, there was a great fad for ethnic songs written in the voices of German Americans, Italian Americans, Jewish Americans, African Americans, kind of making fun of these minorities, but celebrating them at the same time. And this was a song that was sort of done in an oompah style with an oompah band playing in the background. But at the same time, Mel Brooks could have written this song. It is just hilarious. So it's Berlin not only writing an ethnic song, but having his way with it and showing how brilliant he promises to be.
And let's hear a little bit of it. This is Irving Berlin singing, "Oh, How That German Could Love."
I got stuck on a sweet little German, and oh, but a German was she. The best spot was walking, well, what she was talking, but she just made her order for me. So lovely and witty, more yet she was pretty, you don't know until you have tried. She had such a figure.
And that was Irving Berlin himself singing, "Oh, How That German Could Love," a very early song and a very rare recording of Irving Berlin as a performer. And I thought it was important to include that because, you know, frequently we start the Irving Berlin story, we start talking about Irving Berlin with Alexander's Ragtime Band. And it's notable to me that he had multiple hits, notably something about When My Wife Goes to the Country or My Wife Has Gone to the Country, that fit more into that sort of After the Ball or Sidewalks of New York era or the George M. Cohen Yankee Doodle Dandy style of thing that he would supersede and sort of blow away with Alexander's Ragtime Band. Can you talk a little bit about that transition from the early Tin Pan Alley to the Ragtime era and how Berlin epitomized that?
Well, I think the first thing we want to do is say very carefully and emphatically that ragtime, there's a lot of controversy about ragtime, and ragtime has a number of definitions, but by the definition of the great genius Scott Joplin, who was kind of the procreator, the originator of ragtime, Alexander's Ragtime Band is not a ragtime song at all. It is a song about ragtime. It is a song about a band leader named Alexander, an African-American band leader named Alexander. And it's a march, really. It is a call to participate, to enjoy, to sing along, to dance along to ragtime. And it is kind of a, it is a quantum leap from anything Berlin or anybody else had written before. It comes along at precisely the right moment, 1911, only 2 years after Oh, How That German Could Love. Berlin is now an old man of 23 rather than just 21. And he has been writing songs for a few years. He is making very good money writing songs, such good money that he's now able to go on vacation to Florida. He's on his way to Penn Station to take the Orange Blossom Limited down to Florida, a train down to Florida. That's how you traveled in those days. But he has a couple of hours before train time, so he stops by the office, and he has a snatch of song that's playing in his head. And here we should note that Berlin wrote music in quotation marks. He didn't know how to write music or read music. He had songs in his head. He would work with a musical secretary, a man who would sit at a piano. Berlin would stand next to him and hum the tune he had in mind. And the guy at the piano would play the notes and begin to harmonize it, play chords that Berlin would either approve of or disapprove of, tell the guy to change. He went to the office and he wrote down the lyric to a song that he had had in his head, and he had the musical secretary play it and memorialize it, and then he went on vacation to Florida. This whole thing, this stop by the office to write down this song, to take down the notes and the words of it, took maybe 20 minutes. He goes on vacation. He comes back, and this song is put into sheet music, and it is then recorded on the brand new technology of phonograph records, just coming in 1908, 1909, 1910, 1911. And because of the sheet music of Alexander's Ragtime Band and the phonograph record of Alexander's Ragtime Band, the 23-year-old Irving Berlin becomes not just a national celebrity, but an international celebrity. The sheet music and the phonograph records travel across the Atlantic to England, to France, to Spain, to Italy, to Germany. Suddenly, this song is playing everywhere. Berlin gets a commission to come across to the London Hippodrome and perform in a show. They pay him £20,000, which is the equivalent of $2 million today. He's 23. Come over and be in the show. He gets out of his, he sails across the Atlantic. He gets out of his horse-drawn cab at the Savoy Hotel in London. And the kid who's selling newspapers on the corner is whistling Alexander's Ragtime Band. This is the beginning of the American century. It is a huge epoch-making event, this song. It turns Berlin at 23 into an international celebrity and a millionaire.
And I'm glad you brought up the point about this isn't a ragtime song. And I thought you covered that very well, but it does, as you call it, it is a joyous tribute to African-American musical genius, the first great and lasting one in American popular song from a Jewish-American musical genius. And that's just a beautiful, elegant way to summarize what's going on here in this conversation between Jewish-American songwriters and performers and African-American songwriters and performers is something that's going to mark the 20th century as, you know, kind of the American century. And it's a commonly acknowledged to be America's great contribution to the arts.
Yes, and it's not always an easy or an uncomplicated conversation. There are hurt feelings a lot of the time. Scott Joplin himself felt that Berlin had ripped off a piece of melody from his opera Tremonisha and put it into Alexander's Ragtime Band, and actually tried to sue Berlin. The suit never got off the ground. And I think actually the accusation was kind of baseless. But Scott Joplin was a tragic genius, and it was a sad moment in his life. It was an ongoing conversation from the very early 1900s through the teens into the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and beyond, with rock and roll, blues, R&B, a lot of of course, many great African-American innovators and a lot of Jewish-American innovators involved.
And this notion, you know, Berlin being sued by Joplin, and the fact that he had to have a musical secretary to help him find the chords, which he heard in his head. He knew when it was right or wrong. He just didn't have the vocabulary to find the chord he was hearing. And he could only play the piano in F sharp. Like you said, he had a transposing piano. I think this, that in combination with these rumors, you know, he was also hit with rumors that he had purchased the song from a little Negro boy and that he, you know, kept this.
The way they put it then was a little colored boy. Yes.
Yes. And so talk about that a little bit. I mean, because, you know, as a product of the rock era, I've learned about the great American songbook figures, you know, retrospectively and through, you know, going back from Frank Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald and others. And, you know, it's obvious that George Gershwin was this musical genius who could write operas and rhapsodies and contend with the European concert tradition on its own terms, you know, and Richard Rodgers is clearly this melodic genius and Jerome Kern and others. And Berlin always has this, I don't know, people sort of underestimate Berlin because, you know, Alexander Wolcott, his first biographer, called him a creative ignoramus. I mean, there's no book learning there. The guy wasn't a great conversationalist. He wasn't a musical master. And yet, if you look at his accomplishments, he could go toe-to-toe with any of those guys anytime. I mean, you can put Berlin's oeuvre up against Kern or Gershwin or Rodgers or Lennon and McCartney, anybody in the 20th century, at least, as a composer. Do you think he's overcome that sort of discrimination against him because he wasn't a trained musician and because he wasn't a well-educated man and a brilliant conversationalist?
Well, he had a lot to overcome. And as I said before, he had a lot of competition to face up to. Again, the songwriting business was incredibly competitive. And a lot of the rumors about Berlin, I would say probably all the rumors about Berlin, hiring somebody, some kid to write his tunes or some black musician to write his tunes, were started by envious fellow songwriters who just weren't having the success, who didn't have the kind of flows out of your head in the middle of the night genius that Berlin had. Now, at the same time as I talk about that genius, we have to talk about Berlin's unbelievable work ethic. He tended to write through the night. He tended to start maybe at 11 o'clock or 12 midnight, work through to 5 or 6 a.m. And he liked to say a couple of things. One thing he said was that that writing songs was easy. All he had to do was stare at the piano until drops of blood formed on his forehead. He labored so hard for simplicity in his songs. Simplicity was everything to him. The other thing he liked to say was that he wrote more bad songs than anybody. Berlin was a guy who wrote 1,500, published some 1,500 songs in his lifetime. And as he freely confessed throughout his career, a lot of them were dogs. But it takes a huge amount of work. Lennon and McCartney would attest to that, to come up with a really good song. And you have to turn out some crappy songs along the way, a lot of crappy songs, to come up with the cream that rises to the top.
And let's go ahead and hear Alexander's Ragtime Band. This is a version by Bing Crosby and Al Jolson from the 1940s. So don't think this is what it sounded like in 1911. But since we already played the Irving Berlin song from 1909, I felt like the audience had enough of the really early days. But here's Bing Crosby and Al Jolson having a lot of fun with Alexander's Ragtime Band.
Come on in here.
Oh, you dog.
Alexander's Ragtime Band. Come on in here. Come on in here. About the best band in the land.
Take and play a bugle call like you never heard before. So natural that you want to go to war. That's just the bestest band, what am? Oh, honey lamb.
Come on along, come on along. Let me take you by the hand.
Up to the and that was the great Bing Crosby and Al Jolson having fun with Irving Berlin's Alexander's Ragtime Band. And I think that's one thing I wanted to get across is that we have such a compressed view of the past in 2020. And even, you know, you're a boomer, I'm a Gen Xer, but I think we tend to look at all of this music of the first half of the 20th century through this lens of Frank Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald and the sort of art song interpretation of what we call now the Great American Songbook. But I think it's very important to remember this wasn't the Great American Songbook in the 1920s. These were the hits of the day. This was the currency. This was pop hits. And Berlin is having to do everything he can to compete with Gershwin and Rodgers et al., and as well as Louis Armstrong and Bing Crosby and you know, the specter of real jazz. And he's got another hit. You know, we can't cover his whole career because it's just too much, but I'm going to jump ahead to his confrontation. I wouldn't say confrontation, but his triumph in the jazz era, which was Everybody's Step. And you call it white jazz. Explain that terminology a little bit.
Well, Berlin knew his abilities. He was confident in his abilities. One thing he said, and he said it in 1915, when he was 27 years old, he said, "I know rhythm." And he was not kidding. He did understand rhythm. When he wrote Everybody's Step, he was writing a song that used syncopation very effectively. He would also use it effectively, very effectively, a few years later when he wrote the great Puttin' on the Ritz. If you listen to that song and then listen to it again, just listen to where the beats fall and where the emphases fall in that song, and you'll realize that Berlin really did know rhythm. But the song Everybody's Step, as it was performed in the show that it was performed in, and I think we also want to note that these songs of the Great American Songbook were written almost entirely, not as freestanding songs, but to a purpose, for a purpose, for either songs or movies, for shows, for musicals. Everybody's Step, as it was performed in the show by a vocal trio called the Brock Sisters, three young ladies from the South, who sang in very tight harmony, and they were white, they were not black, it was charming, it was delightful, it remains delightful, but it didn't have exactly what you would call soul. I think soul took a while to arrive in Berlin's music. I think it really took until 1933, with Berlin and Moss Hart's great review as Thousands Cheer, and the great Ethel Waters, an African-American, who really made her debut, or her Broadway debut in that show, singing a song called Heat Wave. And she did it very sexily, very jazzily, and she did it the way it needed to be done. But there's a great difference between Everybody's Step by the Brock Sisters and Heat Wave by Ethel Waters.
And he also wrote a song for Ethel Waters called Supper Time. Talk about that a little bit. I mean, that's probably the most socially conscious piece of Berlin's great songs. That's probably the most socially conscious and a self-conscious statement that he made.
Yeah, well, this was a show. The review as Thousands Cheers was a genius idea by Moss Hart and Irving Berlin. It was a musical in the form of a newspaper. And so their great idea, so great it's hard to believe nobody had thought of it before, was to mount a musical on a Broadway stage in the form of a newspaper. And it had a society column, it had a gossip column, it had a sports column, sports page, it had the weather, everything that a newspaper had. And each of these sections of the newspaper, of the fictional newspaper, in the play As Thousands Cheer, had Berlin songs that were appropriate to that section. The second act and the crowd, it was the midst of the Depression, and the people who could afford a Broadway ticket were rich people. So that was an audience, a Broadway audience full of wealthy people enjoying this satirical, sometimes sharply satirical musical Real names were used, feelings weren't spared, but it was all in the spirit of good fun. And this wealthy audience was enjoying the show, and then came the intermission, and then came Act Two. And Act Two began with a cheeky little skit about, it was a slightly risque, it was about a young engaged couple on their wedding day. And the cheekiness of the skit was that they were waking up together, which was very daring, very risque back in 1933. Well, that skit finished up, and then a curtain descended. And on the curtain was printed a big black headline that said, "Unknown Negro Lynched by Frenzied Mob." And the audience, if you've ever seen The Producers, the Mel Brooks movie, when the song Springtime for Hitler is sung and they show a shot of the audience sitting with their mouths open, the audience must have looked like that night as they were watching as thousands cheer, because this headline and then Ethel Waters' presentation of this great song that Berlin had written, like nothing he had ever written before, because it is sung by Ethel Waters in the person of a wife waiting for her husband to come home, but he's not going to come home because he's been lynched. It's a powerful song. It's a terrific song. It predated Billie Holiday's great Strange Fruit, another song about lynching, by 10 years. And it's just an amazing piece of history and an amazing leap forward in Berlin's career.
And it was even a statement to have Ethel Waters in the play in the first place. Is that correct?
That is correct. And three of her white co-stars, when the show was in tryouts out of town in Philadelphia, refused to take their bows with Ethel Waters for one reason, because she was black. And Berlin heard about it, and he informed her three white co-stars that in that case, because they were choosing not to take their bows with Ethel Waters, there would be no bows at all. Well, the three white co-stars changed their minds, and they all took their bows together.
Yeah, and I wanted to get that in there because, you know, Berlin and like many members of his generation, Bing Crosby is the one that comes to mind, is not often... We don't often look back at Berlin and think of him as a civil rights hero, and in part because of things like the Abraham number in Holiday Inn with Bing Crosby, which is one of his great cinematic triumphs. You know, it's Irving Berlin's Holiday Inn. He negotiates this great deal with Hollywood. He's got complete creative control. He's got Bing Crosby.
He's got White Christmas in
there. He's got White Christmas, and you're jumping my gun there on that one. I was going to drop that card in a second, but
sorry.
But that's okay. But he's got, you know, White Christmas. He's got a song about Thanksgiving. He's got an early version of Easter Bonnet, but he's also got this number Abraham with Bing Crosby singing in blackface.
A whole bunch of people singing in blackface, and Crosby, who by the way revered black musicians, was a great jazz singer himself at the beginning of his career, revered black musicians, thought that the whole thing was just good fun. And Berlin thought the whole thing was just good fun. This was a different America. We have to take care not to see that America through the eyes of today's America, or if we do, we have to realize that it was a different place. And so this is not to forgive blackface, which is unforgivable, but it's to understand that in those times it was a tradition in which, by the way, to make things thoroughly complicated, black performers often participated themselves. Now, this is a whole complicated question, the question of black performers putting on blackface to perform musical numbers. But it was a reprehensible number, a reprehensible part of that movie. And when they show the movie these days, it's simply been edited out.
Yeah, I showed it to my daughter recently and had forgotten about Abraham, and we had to stop and have a whole teaching moment about that. You know, she's 6 years old and yeah. You know, it's very incongruous. But Berlin even got in trouble at the time, not for the blackface, but because the song used the term darkies.
Yes.
And he was a product of the time. Because Bing had done similar things.
Yes, well, Bing, I, the, Yeah.
Like having Paul Robeson on his radio show and going out of his way to call him Paul and have Paul Robeson call him Bing, which was very controversial at the time, you know, and getting the Mills Brothers on his radio show. I mean, these guys had done a lot for integration and to advance the cause of African-American musicians, but the rules had changed under their feet. You know, they're middle-aged guys in their 40s. And so I think some of us that have seen the rules change in the Me Too era can sympathize a little bit.
Yes, the rules were changing under their feet. They were doing the best they could. They had good hearts, but they had old-fashioned instincts. They were products of their time and their culture, and they were products of an America that, for the first 55 years at least of the 20th century, was deeply, unapologetically racist. Unapologetically, it was a WASP. Dominated culture, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. Italian Americans weren't even officially considered, legally considered white until the 1940s. It was an awful time in so many ways. And again, as you put it so eloquently, the culture was changing under their feet. They adapted the best they could.
And this happened to Berlin in numerous ways, not just culturally, but the business changed under his feet multiple times. Like, you know, we talked about how he came up in the sheet music era, and it was sheet music, and then records were a secondary promotional tool, but primarily they were selling sheet music for people to play and sing around their piano at home, and also to listen to the record, to a record of the song by multiple performers. You know, any hit song would have multiple versions come out by many performers. And then the radio comes along in the 1920s when he's well into his career, and then the Broadway musical changes, and you got people like Jerome Kern producing things like Showboat in the late 20s. Then you get Gershwin up in the ante again, you know, with Porgy and Bess, and doing a full-on modern musical opera. And Berlin rises to the challenge. He moves to Hollywood in the early 30s. And it's funny that you first kind of came to him, and you talk about this in the foreword, through the Marx Brothers. And he provided the songs for one of their early movies, Coconuts, which is a terrible gig because, you know, no song is going to shine in a Marx Brothers comedy. But he rides through this.
Yeah.
And eventually hooks up with Fred Astaire and goes on this amazing run of hit. Absolute classics.
Absolute classics, and yet at the same time, Berlin missed Broadway badly. He felt like a fish out of water in Hollywood. He adored Astaire, who had the same brilliance that he did, the same kind of intense work ethic that Berlin did, and he adored writing for Astaire. But again, he felt very much out of place in Hollywood. He missed New York badly. He wanted to go back to Broadway.
And let's hear Fred Astaire doing Putting on the Ritz.
Avenue, on that famous thoroughfare, with their noses in the air, high hats and arrow collars, white spats and lots of dollars, spending every dime for a wonderful time. Now if you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits? Putting on the Ritz. Different types of where are they?
And that was Fred Astaire singing Irving Berlin's triumphant Putting on the Ritz. And he does get back to Broadway, but it's not until after World War II that he writes his first modern musical, Annie Get Your Gun. Tell us a little bit about it. Was a coincidence that Berlin got that gig?
No, it was a terrible coincidence because the show that was to have been called Annie Oakley was to have been written by Jerome Kern in conjunction with the great brother-sister librettists and lyricists Herbert and Dorothy Fields. And Jerome Kern was walking to lunch in Manhattan with to meet his wife for lunch one day in 1945, and suddenly dropped to the pavement on Park Avenue with a brain hemorrhage, and he died a week later. So the great Kern is dead at an early age, and Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein, who were who were producing that show. They had written Oklahoma and South Pacific, and now they had sort of transitioned to becoming producers. They were producing Annie Oakley, trying to think who they could hire to write the music for the show. And the first person everybody thought of, Rodgers, Hammerstein, and the Fieldses, was Irving Berlin. But the thing about Berlin was two things. One, his name was always above the title. He had achieved that level of fame and power in Hollywood and on Broadway. And two, he wrote, and we should take note of this too, because there are very few people who stand alongside of him in this regard. There's Cole Porter, there's Frank Lesser, but very few people. He wrote music and lyrics. It's like double genius, not just genius. But they persuaded themselves, and they persuaded Berlin anyway. And Dorothy and Herbert Fields very gracefully stepped back and let Berlin write the lyrics. And Berlin went down to Atlantic City and produced a score for Annie Get Your Gun in some incredible time, like 2 or 3 weeks, the entire score. And it was a great score from a guy who at the beginning had no idea who Annie Oakley was and said that he didn't know how to write hillbilly music, but he wrote it, and he wrote it great.
Yeah, and the phenomenon of that, you know, reading your account of that production, and the fact that he almost pulled two of the great, great songs from that number, there's no business like show business, and anything you can do, I could do better, because he got mixed feedback from his team around him, and that brings us back to the really big numbers, which Irving Berlin, you know, has this incredible catalog that can match Gershwin, et cetera, match any pop singer. But he also wrote two songs, White Christmas and God Bless America, that sort of transcend pop culture and inserted themselves right at the root of American culture. I mean, God Bless America is basically the national anthem. And at various times, there have been official attempts to replace the Star Spangled Banner with it. Berlin wouldn't have anything to do with that when he was alive. But if I was a betting man, I might bet even odds that in the next 100 years, we change our mind and make God Bless America the official song. And White Christmas is the most successful recording in history by a distance you can't fathom. I mean, it was a top 10 hit for 20 straight years in the Bing Crosby recording. Now, what is the meaning of Irving Berlin, this Jewish immigrant who comes in and writes these absolutely integral American songs? And this was controversial. I mean, people like Charles Lindbergh and the America First movement, they were denouncing the idea that a Jew could write songs like this in America.
Yes, they didn't denounce White Christmas. There was vigorous blowback against God Bless America when it was introduced in 1938-1939. This is a time when there was a powerful America First movement, a powerful movement to keep America out of the war that was beginning in Europe. It was only Pearl Harbor that drew us into the war, but for 3 years before that, an awful lot of people in America didn't want to go to war, to shed a single drop of American blood, to save England, to save European Jews, and made a lot of powerful speeches on the radio and in big venues like Madison Square Garden against any effort to help out the Europeans or the British in this war. And so when Berlin introduced God Bless America and America took to it right away, America was so joyous at hearing, most of America was so joyous at hearing this song, but much of America at the same time rebelled against it and yes, said, well, the nerve that this Jewish immigrant had writing a song about God. What did he know about God? God Bless America. And it was seen as an act of presumption by a lot of people.
And I blew my segue there, because the point I was trying to make was Berlin kept God Bless America in his drawer for 20 years. He wrote it in 1918 and thought there are too many patriotic songs right now because of World War I. And just the idea that somebody could first consider not including There's No Business Like Show Business in the play, and then to sit on God Bless America for 20 years. I mean, what an incredible wealth of talent. Were there more treasures unearthed in his archives? Do we know? I mean, have people sifted through his unpublished works in any comprehensive way? Are they even extant?
Well, there is a big Irving Berlin collection at the Library of Congress, and there's just about every piece of paper that he ever put his pen to. I think that his music has been very thoroughly gone through. I think we have. Listen, Nate, what we have is such a cornucopia of brilliance, of greatness, that I think it's greedy for us to ask for anything more. So I don't think that, unlike J.D. Salinger, who knows what great Salinger works might still be published. I don't think there is any hidden, mysterious, lost Berlin work that he was too shy to publish during his lifetime. I think that better angels, whether his or people who were working with him, always came to the fore and persuaded him to publish what he should have published.
Well, that's reassuring. And I'm pretty happy with the amount of topics that we've hit about his career and the industry. But one of my goals was to talk about Berlin as a person. And I think you can't cover that without talking about these incredible tragedies he's faced. First, losing his father at a very young age, which terminated his education and literally put him out on the streets within a couple of years because he felt he wasn't contributing enough to the family and that they'd be better off without him. And then the death of his first wife right after their honeymoon. He takes her to Cuba on a honeymoon, and she takes ill with typhus and dies a few weeks later. And, you know, this is not a guy that we think of as an artiste. He's not somebody who, you know, he's not Sylvia Plath. He didn't reach into his heart and tear out, you know, these songs. But in that case, he did break that pattern and wrote a song called When I Lost You that was very personal.
Yes, it's a beautiful waltz that he wrote in 1912 after the death of his first wife, Dorothy. He was 24 years old. It's a gorgeous song. It has been recorded many times since. It holds up. It is a waltz whose lyrics have a simplicity that he had to really work very, very hard to achieve. It holds up. It was perhaps the one instance in his life where Berlin admitted that he wrote a song about his own personal experience. But I think it's important to know, and there's a loss, Berlin's life was really marked, etched deeply by loss, not only the loss of his father, his first wife, but when he married again, there was an infant son, 3 weeks old, who died on Christmas Day of crib death in 1928. There was that terrible loss, and I think that loss arguably underlies the bittersweet, yearning feeling of the song White Christmas. I think Berlin's entire oeuvre of ballads certainly contains elements, traces, strains of sadness that are deeply informed by the loss that he suffered. And one of the great songwriting tools that he employed to terrific effect, I think, was the shifting of major to minor within songs. It's also, by the way, a device that was very much used by Lennon and McCartney, who both suffered the loss, each suffered the loss of a mother when they were in their adolescence. So loss had a lot to do with Lennon and McCartney ballads as well.
Okay, let's go ahead and hear When I Lost You. This is Frank Sinatra's version from 1962, many decades after the song was written.
And roses I lost, the heavens of blue, I lost the beautiful rainbow, I lost
the more. And that was Frank Sinatra saying Berlin's When I Lost You, a song he wrote for his first wife, who died tragically after their honeymoon. And, you know, you talked about the death of his son, and we've been talking about Irving Berlin as sort of this moral paragon, and many people, you know, he lived with his second wife straight through to their death. They both lived to be quite old, Berlin to 101, and his wife Ellen lived into her late 80s, and they were devoted. There's a touching anecdote in there about their senescence when they're in separate rooms and there's caretakers, and he thinks he's in a hotel room, and he's very concerned that he get a message to his wife, and he wants her to know that she loves him and that he loves her. And they take the message downstairs to his wife, and she sort of laughs, you know, that they say, he wanted you to know you have his love. And she says, I knew that. and that to me speaks of the confidence of a couple that had successfully raised three daughters together, that had lived together for decades. As you said, his mistress was music, but in the 1920s, it was very controversial for a Tin Pan Alley songwriter, a Jewish immigrant, to court the daughter of one of the titans of American industry, Clarence Mackey of a major telegraph company. Talk about that a little bit, and the role of the tabloids and how Berlin reacted to the negative spotlight of fame.
Well, it was rough. They were, as you say, they were a mismatched couple. Berlin was a 35-year-old widower. She was a Jew, and she was a 21-year-old Catholic socialite who wrote amusing pieces for The New Yorker, which was a brand new magazine then. And her father, Clarence Mackey, was not so much a tycoon. His father is a tycoon. He was an heir to a huge fortune, the Comstock Silverlode fortune. A Catholic, and deeply disapproved of this match, and in fact disinherited his daughter when she married Berlin. And this story was just catnip to the newspapers of the day. This was way before TV or the internet. They were the Access Hollywood couple of the day. The newspapers could not get enough of this story about the Catholic socialite, the much older Jewish songwriter, the disapproving father, the disinheriting. The whole thing was drama that played out for month after month and year after year. And it got to the point where Irving and Ellen just couldn't stand the spotlight anymore. There was one moment when Ellen really snapped at a bunch of reporters, and one of whom had the temerity to ask if she was pregnant, her first pregnancy, and she swore at him like a sailor, this very polite young lady. So it was hard on them, but listen, with fame and comes the wages of fame, and these were the wages that came along with their marrying, and they were indeed a happy and long married couple, 63 years in all, and loved each other very deeply,
and even reconciled with her father, who gallantly, I was watching a documentary about Berlin prepping for this, and it just broke me down when they told the story of that Christmas day when they found Irving Berlin Jr. dead in his crib, and Clarence Mackey shows up at the door a few hours later and reclaimed his daughter and forgave her. And you point out in the book that their fortunes had kind of changed. Mackey lost his fortune in the stock market crash, and there was no way to – he reestablished himself as a wealthy man, but never again what he had had before. And Berlin also lost everything in the crash, but he had more songs, and he –
He had a Berlin. Yes, Berlin lost $5 million, his entire fortune, in the stock market crash, $5 million being the equivalent of at least $50 million today, if not more. But Berlin had something else. First of all, he had a wealthy young wife who, despite the fact that she had been disinherited, had an untouchable by her father trust fund that was a source of income. And Berlin was a money engine. He had a money engine. He wrote these songs that continued to generate royalties for his wedding. His wedding gift to his young wife, he gave her then and for all posterity the royalties to the great song Always. So they made out just fine. And yes, there was a kind of reconciliation between Berlin and his father-in-law. I don't think they ever truly reconciled. They were too far apart for that. But they at least became cordial with each other.
Yeah, and more importantly, she was able to reestablish the relationship with her father. And talking about, you know, Berlin bouncing back from the Depression, there was a quote you have in here from him that he had this worry throughout his career that someday I'm going to reach for it and it won't be there. It, meaning his inspiration. And eventually, even after this incredibly long career from, you know, from 1909 to Call Me Madam in the early 50s, he's scoring hits. But eventually there does come a time when he reaches for it and it's not there.
I think it's important to note, too, that Berlin, especially in the wake of World War II, he wrote an all-Army show called This Is the Army that played on Broadway very successfully. All the receipts were donated to the Army Emergency Relief Fund, every penny. He then toured this show with an all-Army cast across the country. A movie was made of it. And then he took the cast over to England, to Great Britain, and to Europe in the midst of World War II, and often close to the front lines within the sounds of guns firing and bombs dropping, performed this show to entertain the troops throughout Italy in 1944 and then the South Pacific in 1944 and 1945. Sometimes at extreme personal danger. This experience in World War II was very intense, very involving, very physically draining to a guy who was getting close to 60 years old. And he was exhausted at the end of the war and suffered a kind of PTSD and fell into a clinical depression. And for 5 years in the early and mid 1950s, was hospitalized with depression. So, and then there came a show after that. He came out of his depression. Nobody knows exactly why or how. In the late 50s or early 60s, he wrote a final musical, Mr. President, in 1962, that was a gigantic flop. So he was reaching for it. It was no longer there. But the age had changed. The time had changed. He had changed. He was an old man, and the 60s were in, and the music business had completely metamorphosed.
And he goes on, you know, to live another several decades, basically as a complete recluse, and allows them to have a 100th birthday party that he doesn't attend, but is a big fitting show business extravaganza with many performances. And you singled out Madeleine Kahn's tawdry take on one of his numbers for special notice.
Yes, you'd be surprised. It is a wonderful performance of a wonderfully dirty song without a single dirty word.
That was an art that they had in the days of the censorship. And like so many arts, we might have lost the ability to create new contributions to the Great American Songbook. We can always go back and listen. We can always sit down at the piano and try to play them ourselves. And so, James Kaplan, it's been a great treat talking about Irving Berlin in your book, Irving Berlin, New York Genius. And I hope we can have you back on the show to talk about Frank Sinatra.
I'd love to, Nate. It's a great pleasure speaking with you.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Nate will be back next week with the Rock and Roll Librarian to discuss the classic biography of The Doors' Jim Morrison, No One Here Gets Out Alive. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to all the other great Pantheon podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Irving Berlin, New York Genius is published by Yale University Press. Please support our show by ordering via the Amazon referral link on our website, letitrollpodcast.com.
everybody. This is Brian Reisman, host of the podcast Side Jams, which is now a proud member of the Pantheon family of podcasts. I've been a freelance entertainment journalist for 25 years now, and I often end up in conversations that go off on tangents. Suddenly you're discussing someone's outside passion or hobby, something you didn't know about, and it leads into revelations about their character and about their life outside of their art. I've often had to cut those details out because a story had a strict word count or a specific focus, so here, the entire focus of the podcast is just on their side jam or side jams. For example, Alice in Chains frontman William Duvall spent some time talking to me about reading history, which led him into talking about his public school education and how it was so terrible in high school that he actually managed to get into a private school for free so his life could take a different course. In this series of podcasts, you're going to be hearing my interviews with musicians of all different backgrounds and genres, talking about everything from surfing to collecting antiques to stargazing. I hope you enjoy Side Jams. Please tune in regularly, and I'll have a lot of interesting guests in store for you.
Splash Weather Repel Premium Windshield Wash features a 3-in-1 formula that repels rain, sleet, snow, and bugs while leaving a streak-free shine. And its advanced beading technology keeps you seeing safely all year long.
See safely on the road when you apply a little splash.
Pick some up at Walmart today.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.